KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In the mid-1700s, Benjamin Franklin brought the ideals of the Enlightenment to a nascent United States. This laid the foundation for the political revolution that would follow. Historian Jonathan Lyons spoke about the Founding Father and the country's intellectual coming of age in this talk, recorded at Town Hall on June 27, 2013.
It's really wonderful to be here in Seattle. As I mentioned to some of you when I first arrived, my wife and I have only recently relocated to the Pacific Northwest. We're based out of Portland, Oregon, having left Washington, D.C., the other Washington. There is one institution I miss, and I probably always miss, and that's the Library of Congress, where I wrote this book and most of my three earlier books as well. But I know that quality of life and the quality of discourse, particularly civic discourse, will be greatly improved. And I know also that Benjamin Franklin would be particularly pleased to know that I'm speaking here tonight and that he would commend this institution on its civic-mindedness. Franklin was what is known as a projector, that is, he loves projects, social projects. And for him, as I hope to show you tonight, knowledge was a social activity, and that is really exemplified by the programs you have here at Town Hall. But I do have to say one thing. I think he would probably frown at the Roman Revival architecture. Again, as I hope to make clear, Franklin was an implacable foe of classical learning and felt that it was a real weight around the neck of middle class and aspiring workers who wanted to get educated. The notion they had to learn Latin and Greek just so they could then study philosophy was anathema to him. Before I launch into an overview of the project, I want to tell you a little bit about the history of this particular book. This is a new direction for me, and it would be fair for you to be wondering where that direction came from. I'll tell you this much. That direction came from a footnote. I'm one of those readers, and I'm sure some of you are as well, who really like to read footnotes. Not those footnotes that have citation, the page number and the volume, but footnotes where an author really contributes something, recognizes that a fact or a point of discussion is worthy of inclusion, but it somehow doesn't fit into their narrative. Well, that's really rich material for me, because I can come along and say, well, that's pretty cool. Maybe I should look into that. So I was reading something completely unrelated to American history. It probably comes as no surprise that it was a work of cultural criticism on the relationship between Islamic world and the Western world. In any case, there was a footnote, and it mentioned the role of these societies for useful knowledge. And I thought, wow, that's something that I need to look into. And I did. And the actual reference was to the British institution. But as I started to explore the subject, I found that a very rich history here in America. And as I got more and more involved, the figure of Benjamin Franklin kept kind of encroaching on my thinking. And so I decided to look at this movement, as I call it, for useful knowledge through the eyes of Franklin and use his life story to help tell the saga, the genesis, the development, and the import of this movement for useful knowledge. This is not to say that I wrote a biography of Benjamin Franklin. I very deliberately did not. Now, working in the Library of Congress can be a bit daunting because of the size of the collection, and if you go to the catalog or go online and put in Benjamin Franklin title search, you get over 1,000 volumes. So I figured, well, the market was kind of saturated with Benjamin Franklin biographies. Instead, the Society for Useful Knowledge explores the roots of early American technology and science. And these are forces that steadily transform this country first into an industrial superpower, and only then into a geopolitical one. Now, accounts of such inventiveness are the stuff of legend. We talk about the Wright brothers, Thomas Edison, Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and of course we could add many others. Henry Ford, Bill Gates, local boy makes good, comes to mind. And we often hear this phrase, only in America. And it's often associated with these kind of figures. Only in America could two bicycle mechanics launch an aviation industry and so forth. Now, what's important here is that all of these figures share a number of key traits. Well, one, they were largely or wholly self-taught. That is, they were not products of formal education. As a result, they had freed themselves from the constraints of conventional wisdom and traditional authority. They preferred practical solutions to theoretical discussion. They were, in essence, engineers, not mathematicians. In other words, they were supreme practitioners of what I mean by useful knowledge. Now, attempts in general to explain America's technological prowess, I found, generally revolve around the notion that it is our political and social systems that provided the ideal platform for innovation and for the associated economic growth, prosperity, and the pursuit of happiness. So in this view, it was the New Republic shaped by the Founding Fathers that set the stage for an explosion of innovation during the 19th and 20th centuries, an explosion that we can all agree continues to this day. Key components of this success would include the creation of a liberal democracy, our laissez-faire approach to capitalism, the passage of strong patent law and other protections for intellectual property. Yet, I would argue that this is what is known as a history of the present. That is, it is a misreading of historical developments derived by working backward from today's America. And my overarching purpose in writing The Society for Useful Knowledge is to propose a very different reading of American history. Now, as I show in my book, and as I can only really outline for you today, the American Revolution represents less a turning point than a significant milestone in a journey that began not at Lexington and Concord in the spring of 1775, but in the study circles, public libraries, and useful knowledge societies that took shape in colonial cities and towns almost 50 years earlier. So long before there was a Boston Tea Party or any other overt acts of defiance to imperial British rule, American practitioners of useful knowledge and the institutions that they developed successfully challenged the social, the political, and the intellectual order of the day. The accompanying knowledge revolution, which is epitomized by Franklin and the circles and his immediate circles, beginning as early as the 1720s, freed the colonists of constraints imported and imposed from Europe. And it was this knowledge revolution that laid the groundwork for American independence. So the central actors in my story, not surprisingly, are not the Founding Fathers per se, although a number of them do make cameo appearances. Jefferson, of course, was very involved in science. Washington and Hamilton, among others, were members of the American Philosophical Society, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. And of course, Franklin straddled both the political and scientific worlds. Rather, my focus is on an earlier cohort of artisans, craftsmen, and independent farmers captivated by two particular ideas borrowed from the European Enlightenment and then shaped by the American experience. So what were these? Well, one, that the value of learning and knowledge, that is what we would call information and data perhaps today, is directly proportional to its practical import or utility. In other words, to be of any real value, knowledge has to be truly useful. And second, that anyone, not just the high-born, the well-educated, those fluent in Latin and Greek, could take part in the pursuit of knowledge and in the pursuit of science and the pursuit of knowledge in general. So what we really had here was in this growing, budding movement that sort of gathered momentum was a movement for useful knowledge was and a challenge to traditional elites who maintained their elite status through an educational system that was relatively restrictive, particularly in Europe. And colonial education was dominated by the same elites, and they wanted their sons, it was only sons at the time who received higher education, to have the mark of a real gentleman, which meant Latin and Greek learning. Franklin and his circle started to see things quite differently, and at one point he writes a letter to a young woman whom he's tutoring in natural philosophy or science, and he says, "What signifies philosophy that does not apply to some use?" This is very much Franklin's mantra and became kind of the slogan of the movement for useful knowledge. Another aspect that's worth highlighting is that anyone could contribute. Now, these ideas came out of England, Francis Bacon, John Locke, David Hume, among others, had proposed a new way of doing science, one that allowed for not just the elites, but the petty merchant, the craftsman, even the unskilled or untrained laborer to contribute something meaningful to science. But it really was American conditions where we didn't have an entrenched system of ruling elites. We had elites borrowed who came across the ocean with the early colonists, but there was much more fluidity within the social system. And so as a result, there were demands from the bottom up for education, and education that was truly useful. So if the American Rebellion was at heart a knowledge revolution, as I argue, then who were the revolutionaries? So let's take a look at some of the leading figures in early American movement for useful knowledge, all of whom appear as important characters in my book. I'm sorry, I have the wrong one there. There we go. Benjamin Franklin and the Junta. Yes, of course, we'll talk about Franklin in a few minutes in greater detail and his role in breaking through sort of knowledge barriers imposed by the Europeans. But before that, I want to introduce a few other figures who are perhaps less known. The farmer and botanist John Bartram. Bartram was a Quaker. He lived a little bit outside Philadelphia. He gradually got drawn into the intellectual life of Philadelphia through Franklin and his associates. We'll speak about him a bit more later. The glazier and mathematician Thomas Godfrey. Godfrey was a member of Franklin's inner circle, and he invented an improved quadrant for navigation. Now, interestingly, he sent this plan off to London, which was then the sort of heart of Anglophone science, claiming credit for a new improved method of navigation, and someone independently had invented a very similar system and happened to be sitting on the board of the Royal Society, which was then the main arbiter of science. And well, you can guess what happened, who got the official credit. It was eventually sorted out, and Godfrey has been recognized as a co-inventor of an improved quadrant. Ebenezer Kinnersley. Ebenezer Kinnersley was a minister who was in trouble with the Congregational Church in Philadelphia. Franklin, who was a big newspaper publisher at the time, had gone to bat for Kinnersley. They'd failed. And so Kinnersley was out of work, and Franklin suggested that he take the results of their electrical experiments and take them on the road as itinerant lecturers. And Kinnersley eventually became the most successful itinerant lecturer in American colonial history, traveling from the far north all the way down to the Caribbean. Now, these lectures were very important to the movement for useful knowledge because they gave access to the latest ideas and inventions, experiments, and hypotheses to a very broad audience that was not university trained. And it also highlighted the fact that knowledge was a personal face-to-face experience. You would go to one of Kinnersley's electrical shows, and he would give you a few minutes of explanation about the latest thinking about electricity. But the fun stuff was he would get out his apparatus, they would generate static electricity, people would touch the globe, their hair would stand on end. He would shock people. They would use electrified swords to set alcohol or other spirits on fire. You know, it was all a good show, but it's not just show. There were two very important aspects here. One was it was much more widely available to a broader audience, but even more importantly, 18th century science was very much connected with the bodily experience of knowledge. It was not the theoretical realm, and so it was very important to this practical knowledge movement, useful knowledge movement, that people could see or even experience for themselves the effects of these scientific phenomena. And then finally, instrument maker David Rittenhouse. Rittenhouse really stands out as a self-taught instrument maker and astronomer. He built a very beautiful and very complex planetarium known as an orrery. Imagine a clock that not only tells you the time and the phases of the moon, but it purports to tell you the accurate position of all five visible planets for any given date, forward in time by 5,000 years or backward in time by 5,000 years. It really was a wonder, and it did two things that were important. It got the attention of the Europeans. This was an amazing feat, especially for a colonial, self-taught farmer's boy. But it also gave the founding fathers' generation a model of a universe that worked according to these Newtonian laws, precision. You wound it up, you lifted the weight, and it ran on its own. And this was very much an attractive political and social model, that we would set these rules for behavior, and society, like the universe, like the orrery, would just run on its own. Now, I put the dates of their birth and death here for a reason. I want you to note how virtually all of them, Franklin is an own case, because a unique case because he lived so long, and Rittenhouse was a little bit younger. But for the most part, this generation predated, at least their formative and mature years, predated the American Revolutionary Project and the birth of the new republic. Their energies were largely devoted to ideas and inventions that would improve the quality of colonial life, overcome the numerous obstacles facing the community, and expand its scientific horizons. Franklin called these people the middling sorts. And what's notable about these figures and many others around them were, in fact, their social origins. Most were drawn from the urban craftsmen or artisans, rather than from the ranks of gentlemen who typically held sway in the colonial towns and cities. Now, collectively, they were known as mechanics. That's a word, of course, we tend to associate with car mechanics, but it has quite a rich history. And they came together not only to pursue science and knowledge in general, but also to advance their own social, economic, and political interests. Now, contemporary, particularly British usage, defined the mechanic as a practitioner of, quote, those arts wherein the hand and body are more concerned than the mind. And in England, the term mechanic carried with it residual class prejudice. This was very much not the case here in the New World. There was a shortage of skilled labor in colonial America, and so they were accompanying high wages, a general lack of restrictive regulations. For example, Franklin's own father had come from Oxfordshire in England, where he came from a long line of silk dyers, and that was his profession, and he really was unable to change his profession within the guild system. But when he came to America, he found dyeing of silk was not in great demand, wasn't so much luxury. He became a candle and soap maker. And this was a pattern that's followed quite consistently. Without restrictive guild regulations, people were much freer to pursue new interests, to develop new skills, and that too played into this notion that we can have useful knowledge, practical knowledge that advances not only our own social position, but that of our society. So as a result, many of these master craftsmen, or even a mechanic, or even a lowly journeyman, could aspire to become an independent entrepreneur with considerable economic security and accompanying social status and political influence. This movement was further buoyed by, particularly in New England with the Puritans, and even more so in and around Philadelphia with a large Quaker population. Both sects put a premium on labor, and particularly on the nobility of labor, the dignity of labor. And so working with one's hands, producing something, laboring honestly, was a social good that perhaps and carried connotations that it didn't always carry back in Europe. So as I say, even the journeyman could hope to save enough funds to buy land and become an independent farmer or to go into business for himself. Hence it is, wrote Franklin, that artisans generally live better and more easily in America than in Europe, and such as our good economists make a comfortable provision for age and for their children. In 1727, Franklin and 11 others formed the Leather Apron Club. Now, the leather apron was worn by craftsmen and artisans, and a leather apron was a collective way of referring to this rising class. And so they called themselves the Leather Apron Club, but it was very quickly known simply as the Junta or Junta. And the leather apron was, of course, the badge of honor for these members as mechanics. So I want to read to you a brief section from my book about the meetings of the Junta. We're in Philadelphia now in 1727 and the years immediately thereafter. Franklin's own group, soon known simply as the Junta, combined the conviviality of a private drinking club with the advantages of a mutual aid society, the moral and intellectual self-improvement of a discussion circle, and the altruism of a civic association. Membership was restricted to 12, and proceedings were conducted in secret, all the better to advance the participants' projects, facilitate planning, and pursue career advancement. It also protected, the junta argued, Franklin, who, by the way, was the biggest proponent of secrecy here, from awkward solicitation for membership from friends and associates. Gatherings of the junta were held at the Indian King Tavern on Market Street, one of the oldest drinking establishments that were integral to Philadelphia's civic life. Here, out-of-town visitors could find lodgings, and locals could hold meetings, attend concerts, or sample the latest news and gossip. The Masonic Lodge, another Franklin project, later held some of its earliest meetings at the Indian King, and the final order to evacuate American forces and leave the town to the advancing British in September of 1777 was issued from the bar. But for now, the junta met each week at the Indian Head to discuss personal and professional advancement of its members, as well as the prevailing idiom of science or natural philosophy and the language of social improvement. Quote, "The rules that I drew up required that every member, in turn, should produce one or more queries on any point of morals, politics, or natural philosophy to be discussed by the company," recalls Franklin. In addition, each participant was expected to deliver an original paper once every 3 months. Now, Franklin was a very organized person, as you may have guessed, and he wrote out what he called queries for the junta. The idea was, before each meeting, each junta member was to wake up early in the morning and read this list and then think about it throughout the day, and hopefully that would spur something that he could contribute at the meeting. So, have you met with anything in the author you have last read, remarkable or suitable to be communicated to the junta? And we see that the breadth of subjects, history, morality, poetry, physic, which refers to medicine, travels, mechanic arts, or other parts of knowledge. Do you think of anything at present in which the junta may be serviceable to mankind? That's Franklin's italics. To their country, to their friends, or to themselves? This last question is quite interesting because while junta members clearly were interested in their own advancement and that of their rising social class, the leather aprons, knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge was seen as a civic good for the broader community. And so the emphasis on being of service to mankind was italicized for a reason.
Jonathan Lyons, the author of The Society for Useful Knowledge, How Benjamin Franklin and Friends Brought the Enlightenment to America. Lyons spoke at Town Hall on June 27th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Jonathan Lyons in a moment, 829-94.9-KUOW. A journalist at the site of a serious train accident in Spain describes the rather horrific scene following the derailment. We'll hear that later this evening. Also, an endangered lizard in Alberta, get this, defends itself by squirting blood from its eyes. The president of the Quebec Junior Lacrosse League defends the conduct of players and officials after a coach withdrew his team for fear of its safety. And the Tunisia location that stood in for a city in a Star Wars movie is about to be engulfed by a giant sand dune. Sounds almost science fiction in itself. All of those items tonight at 11 on CBC's As It Happens. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 50s, mostly clear. For Friday, highs around 80 degrees, patchy fog in the morning, otherwise sunny. Friday night, lows in the 50s, mostly clear. Saturday, highs all the way down to around 70 degrees all of a sudden, mostly cloudy with patchy fog in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Jonathan Lyons is a historian and the author of The Society for Useful Knowledge, How Benjamin Franklin and Friends Brought the Enlightenment to America. Lyons spoke about the Founding Father at Town Hall on June 27, 2013. Next, he talks about how Franklin formed the American Philosophical Society.
So Franklin outlined this program, and he drafted in all 24 queries or questions to guide discussion. But it wasn't all talk. He noted at one point, we must, quote, pause while one might fill and drink a glass of wine. After all, they were meeting in a tavern. In the summer months, members gathered outdoors for calisthenics. They even had their own club song. And Franklin decreed that it should be, quote, hummed in consort by as many as can hum it. Over time, the junta emerged as a driving force in the civic life of Philadelphia, and its projects focused on the needs of fellow mechanics and on practical solutions to economic and social problems facing this new class of Americans. So the junta really was an incubator of practical solutions. Let's look at some of them. Paper currency. The provinces, in Pennsylvania in particular, suffer from an acute shortage of paper currency. Now, this was okay with the economic and political elite because they were mostly creditors. And they were concerned that the issuance of paper money would devalue the value of their outstanding loans and their interest payments. But for craftsmen, particularly, say, a silversmith or a watchmaker or even a printer like Franklin, they had to go into debt to buy supplies. And so repaying these debts was very difficult. Franklin wrote one of his best early papers advocating the creation of a paper currency. The ideas grew out of junta discussions. He showed them drafts. They worked on them together. And now, as the owner of a printing press, he also could print this, which he did. And he won the day. And so eventually the Pennsylvania Assembly did pass a law creating paper currency, overriding the traditional interests of the elite. And not surprisingly, Franklin benefited as well. How did he benefit? Well, the Assembly gave Franklin and his printing press the contract to produce the currency for Pennsylvania, and he eventually extended his contractual arrangements with nearby New Jersey and Delaware. They created fire brigades. Philadelphia had a lot of very small wooden houses, very closely packed together. He hadn't yet created the lightning rod, so lightning and lightning fire sparked by lightning were a real problem, particularly for people who did not live in great brick and stone houses that were distant from their neighbors. So the junta created the basis for a fire brigade and for fire insurance. They improved street lighting and cleaning. Franklin tweaked the design of the traditional Philadelphia street lamp to make it more efficient, burn brighter. The Franklin stove, where did that come from? Well, the junta was debating one day the two problems with contemporary heating technology. One is the high price of firewood, a problem we still know about today, and the fact that they all lived in very smoky houses. And so the result was a high efficiency or a relatively high efficiency stove, which we call the Franklin stove. He called the Pennsylvania stove. And he published the plans in his newspaper. Significantly, I think, Franklin never patented any of his inventions. And I note with interest there were recently some very important Supreme Court cases on intellectual property and whether a certain type of DNA could be patented, and the court ruled that it could not. But in the run-up to the case, the advocates for patent protection were quoting all the founding fathers about the importance of intellectual property. And yes, there is quite a strong record in that regard. But I think that argument overlooks that for Franklin, for Jefferson, for Washington, for a lot of these people, it was the social aspect of knowledge that was important, not the individual right it conferred on one inventor. These products that we associate, these developments, including lightning rod, which we associate with Franklin, and it's fair enough to do, but these were group efforts, and he knew that. The Library Company of Philadelphia grew out of a junta project to pool the members' books into one collection so they could swap books and expand their horizons. But they found three problems. One is they all had the same books. Two is they didn't have that many books. And three, they kept forgetting whose books were whose, and so they were always sort of running around chasing books. And in fact, if you read the Pennsylvania Gazette of the day, there are often little notices saying, I lost my copy of John Locke, you know, edition 6, 1728, or whatever. Does anyone have it? I can't remember to whom I lent it. So they decided to create a subscription library, and they expanded the circle. And that laid the groundwork for a number of subscription libraries, mostly run by mechanics, some run by laborers, heavily influenced by Quaker choices of in literature and in science. The most popular books, if you look at what the earliest catalog was, in addition to John Locke, were books on how to do basic mathematics, how to do scientific experiments, some of Newton's simpler works, if there is such a thing. And this laid the groundwork for the great Philadelphia Public Library System, one of the great library systems in the country, and where I'll have the pleasure of speaking. However, both the Library of Congress, Philadelphia, and the American Philosophical Society move very, very slowly. And so while I am invited to present this book there, it will not be until March of 2014. The junta was also upset, Franklin in particular, that Pennsylvania, which was Philadelphia by now is the leading city in the colonies, didn't have a college or a university or even an institution of an academy of any note. And so they laid the groundwork for what became the University of Pennsylvania. Now, Franklin's efforts on behalf of the University of Pennsylvania in many respects should be seen as a smashing success. It's one of the great institutions in this country. However, in Franklin's mind, it was a complete failure. Why was that? Franklin and the junta raised money, outlined the potential curriculum, developed the plan, marketing plan, essentially raised the money, and the main thrust of their argument and appeal was, we are going to create an institution of higher education that focuses on practical knowledge, surveying, mathematics, engineering, Latin and Greek, we'll put them to one side. However, when the elite of Philadelphia managed to take over the board of trustees, they overrode all of these plans. And so the English curriculum, or the English school it was called, was given second position, short shrift, and eventually almost phased out. And to his very dying day, Franklin was extremely bitter about the way this program had been hijacked in his mind by what he called a cabal of the province's leading gentlemen. So here we have a lovely and fairly not so widely known, that's why I've included a picture of young Franklin in a fireman's cap. This was Franklin leading the charge to protect the houses and assets of his fellow leather aprons. So let's look at the knowledge societies. The 18th century was very much an age of the learned society, the Royal Society of London, which I mentioned before. And by the way, its full name is the Royal Society of London for the Improvement of Natural Knowledge, was the primary model for the Americans. The Quaker farmer, John Bartram, who I introduced earlier, together with Franklin, proposed the first American society in 1743. However, it took a number of decades for the idea to truly bear fruit. At one point, Franklin writes to a friend, "The gentlemen are very idle. They will take no pains." Now, John Bartram, who was more of a taciturn figure than Franklin, blamed it all on the propensity of his fellow members to sit in the taverns and play dice. Now, the example set by Philadelphia with its lively intellectual scene spurred a number of imitators, and eventually the movement for useful knowledge would take hold in Washington, which was now the new national capital, Trenton, New Jersey, Albany, New York, Alexandria, Virginia, and as far south as Carolina and Mississippi, and as far west as Kentucky. More specialized knowledge associations devoted to manufactures, improvements in agriculture, the study of natural history. There was even a military philosophy society founded at West Point. These all appeared as well. These groups were invariably local or regional in scope. And if you look at the names, they almost always have at least a town or city associated with them and often a province. It was very specific. So the early precursor to the American Philosophical Society went through a number of names, but it would include something like the Philosophical Society or the Society for the Advancement of Useful Knowledge or Practical Knowledge held in Philadelphia in the province of Pennsylvania. And from our perspective, when you read this, it seems sort of silly, but it's important to understand that in 18th century thinking, knowledge and its pursuit was a personal face-to-face experience. It had to be done locally. It had to be done through face-to-face connections, through lectures. You had to have members needed to live nearby, ideally so they could come to regular meetings. This also had the advantage of giving a broad section of each of these communities access to these localized groups. Now, when it was impossible for everyone to get together, the knowledge movement organized very highly directed systems of correspondence, generally coordinated by a secretary or other functionary to fill in the gaps. Now, many of us will probably recall from our school days that Franklin was postmaster. Well, he wanted to be postmaster for a couple of reasons. One is he wanted a pretty good salary. He wanted the social status. But most of all, in that day, the recipient of mail paid the postage, not the sender. But Franklin, as postmaster, could send letters and receive them for free. So what did he want to do? He wanted to act as a sort of clearinghouse for scientific correspondence, and he could do this at no cost. So he lobbied very heavily and became postmaster, but one of the things he did then was to expand the reach of the postal system, not just to expand the reach of colonial businessmen and correspondents in general, but to expand his own reach within the scientific system that he was developing.
Jonathan Lyons, the author of The Society for Useful Knowledge, How Benjamin Franklin and Friends Brought the Enlightenment to America. Lyons spoke at Town Hall on June 27th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Jonathan Lyons in a moment. 841, 94.9 KUOW. There is debate over the future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a conversation about efforts to privatize most of the U.S. mortgage market and what that could mean for the housing recovery. That's tonight at midnight. Weather outlook for the Seattle area. For tonight, lows in the 50s, mostly clear. Friday, highs around 80 degrees. Patchy fog in the morning, otherwise sunny. Friday night, same as tonight, lows in the 50s, mostly clear. Saturday, all of a sudden cooler, highs around 70, mostly cloudy with patchy fog in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny. Journalist and author Susan Orlean talks about her passions and her creative process. Also, Elizabeth Dunn, a psychology professor at the University of British Columbia, talks about her book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, and a look back at the 1965 sensation of Namu the killer whale, who was held in captivity on the Seattle waterfront for about a year before dying of a bacterial infection. All three of those items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Jonathan Lyons is a historian and the author of The Society for Useful Knowledge, How Benjamin Franklin and Friends Brought the Enlightenment to America. Lyons spoke about the Founding Father at Town Hall on June 27, 2013. Next, he continues to discuss the Enlightenment in the United States.
But one of the greatest obstacles facing these early American efforts was the entrenched European prejudice against colonial science. It was widely accepted at the time that the colonies would act merely as suppliers of raw materials. So we have seeds of local plants, narrative accounts of strange animals or diseases, the bones of unknown critters, and so on, for study, classification, and explanation by the natural philosophers back in the mother country. This information then would be sent back as science. So in this way, scientific knowledge followed the same pathway as trade in basic commodities and their subsequent transformation into high-value finished goods for sale back to the colonies. So think of iron ore. Iron ore shipped out of Virginia, goes back to England, is eventually made into steel and then fabricated into steel implements, which are then shipped back to the colonies and sold at a high markup. This is the essence of the colonial mercantile system. There was a parallel knowledge economy in which science, the raw materials, were provided by Americans. John Bartram, as we'll see in a minute, was one of the leading suppliers, but they were not supposed to do science. The science was done in the mother country. So as I say, the career of John Bartram really illustrates this phenomenon, and it provides a valuable context for understanding just what a breakthrough Benjamin Franklin and his Philadelphia colleagues later achieved. Now, Bartram was a taciturn farmer, as I mentioned, on a remote property outside Philadelphia. And as he was drawn into the intellectual life of the junta, he eventually became an active collector on behalf of the Royal Society in London. He worked for the Swedish botanist Carl Linnaeus, and at one point even for the British king. The London merchant and Royal Society member Peter Collison served as Bartram's main contact with European science. At his direction, Bartram traveled widely, often abandoning his farming duties for weeks at a time, to fulfill Collison's endless request for more specimens. I want to read briefly from a chapter devoted to John Bartram. By all accounts, Bartram bore up remarkably well under these exacting demands, ranging far and wide and enduring numerous hardship in the wilderness to fulfill his missions. On an expedition to the Cedar Swamp of New Jersey to collect pine cones for the Duke of Norfolk, Bartram struggled against the elements. He writes in his journal, "I climbed the trees in the rain and lopped off the boughs, then must stand up to my knees in snow to pluck off the cones." On another trip, Bartram devoted 2 weeks of what he called painstaking effort to track down the rare willow-leafed oak, only to have most of its treasured acorns, quote, devoured by squirrels and hogs. No request, it seems, was too demanding or too daunting. The American furnished muskrat skins, a hornet's nest, samples of native ginseng for a proposed export scheme to China, and even live turtle eggs that Collinson received just in time to see one hatch. For the most part, Collinson and his colleagues were not particularly interested in what Bartram might think or what firsthand experience might tell him, but only in what he could collect and then send back to Europe for their study and analysis. In fact, Collinson openly discouraged the American from engaging in scientific speculation. Quote, "The box of seeds came very safe and in good order," he reported in one letter. Thy remarks on them are very curious, but I think take up too much of thy time and thought. I would not make my correspondence burdensome, but must desire thee to continue the same collections once again. Throughout their lengthy correspondence, Collinson is explicit that it's only the opinion of the experts back in Europe that carry any weight, and he dismissed Bartram's own views on the existence of two separate varieties of American cedar, the red and the white. Until the details of the plant could be examined by natural philosophers in London, in Oxford, Berlin, or Uppsala, quote, "half a dozen by way of specimen will be sufficient. For though you call it white cedar, we are in doubt what class it belongs to until we see the seed pods." Collinson regularly forwarded some of Bartram's samples to his expert colleagues, who assigned them Latin names in accordance with the latest thinking on plant classification, and then returned these rulings to Bartram for his own edification. Quote, "Send more seed," Collinson requested in a letter of March 14, 1736. "All the specimens went to Oxford. When they are sent back with their names, thee shall hear from me." Now, by contrast, Franklin and his colleagues, known as the Philadelphia Electricians, forced the Europeans to make room for American science. So let's take a look at what they did. They confirmed the identity of electricity and lightning. Now, the notion that lightning in the sky and the electricity produced in the laboratory or in these lecture halls, salons, were one and the same had been kicking around for quite some time. And in fact, the great French expert Nollet, Jean-Antoine Nollet, had noted that sparrows electrocuted in the lab, if you cut them open and look at their innards, resembled the innards of a man who'd been struck by lightning. And so the notion, and there were also other signs, the smell of sulfur was in the air, the sound of a lightning strike seemed to mimic, in much greater volume, of course, the snap of light, of electricity from a capacitor or other device. But it was Franklin and the Americans who really made a breakthrough by coming up with a practical means to verify this notion. They also advanced a plausible explanation of the Leyden jar, which was a simple capacitor built from a glass jar filled with iron shot and then water and wired. And you could charge this with static electricity. It would hold a charge, and then you could release it for experimental purposes or to shock your neighbors, your friends, or your guests at an itinerant lecture or a salon. They invented and named the battery, which was essentially stringing together a series of Leyden jars. They distinguished between negative and positive electrical charge. And they set the stage for the development of the lightning rod. Now, in 1753, the Royal Society of London awarded Franklin its highest honor, which was known as the Copley Medal. This was essentially the Nobel Prize, in our terms, a Nobel Prize for science. Unlike Bartram and other North American naturalists whose works could be absorbed seamlessly into existing European conceptions of plant and animal life, Franklin and his fellow electricians produced a true achievement in basic science, one that featured a revolutionary theory to explain observations derived from experimentation. This, says the intellectual historian Brooke Hindle in his classic study of early American science, represented, quote, "the most important scientific contribution made by an American in the colonial period." Now, the adulation of the Royal Society marked a quick reversal of fortune for Franklin and for colonial science. The initial reaction to the work of the Philadelphia electricians had been dismissive, a fact that still rankled Franklin many decades later, and their subsequent findings were, quote, laughed at by the connoisseurs. I mentioned Nolet. His theories were seriously undermined by Franklin's approach, and he refused to believe his eyes. He was overwhelmed by the absurdity that there could even be an American scientist. And he confides to an ally that this so-called Benjamin Franklin guy was surely the fictitious creation of his own jealous rivals in England. Now we have a lovely picture here, a portrait by Benjamin West, showing just how important in the popular imagination Franklin's work on the lightning rod was. And here he is with cherubs and angels protecting mankind from the ravages of lightning. Franklin's experiments were carried out around the world. There's a lovely Japanese woodcutting I found in the collection of the Library of Congress. This is not the kite experiment. This is what's known as the sentry box experiment. It was actually Franklin's first proposal, and it was carried out in Europe before Franklin got a chance to try it out, and it did successfully demonstrate the identity of lightning and electricity. Now, Franklin also excelled at the art of scientific correspondence, that is, the elaborate and coordinated exchange of information with colleagues across Europe and throughout the colonies, what we today would call social networking. Over time, he established himself as the chief representative of science, with all significant flows of information running through his hands. Franklin today, no doubt, would be a leading tweeter and blogger with millions of followers. It would be impossible to keep track. This helped solidify his position and prestige and enabled him to spread his work, ideas, and influence around the world. It also redounded to his benefit and to the cause of the American rebellion against the British. Franklin's prestige as a scientist made him a formidable diplomat and advocate of the American cause. Now, many of you may be familiar with David McCullough's wonderful book about John Adams. It was made into a film. Franklin is in France. The revolution is ongoing. He's representing the American cause. He's trying to get the French to come around with more money and eventually with military support. Adams is sent over there, and he's furious. What's Franklin doing? Well, he's sleeping late. He's eating enormous meals. He's drinking wine. He's going to dinners, and he's flirting with all the rich women. And Adams is just apoplectic. You've got to be doing something. What he didn't understand was that Franklin was, in fact, performing a very effective diplomatic act. How was he doing that? Well, he was already a scientist of enormous reputation in France. And now he coupled it with sort of examples of he was an American sage, he was a wise man, and it carried enormous weight with leaders of French public opinion and eventually with the court. But it deeply upset Adams, who wrote to his wife, I believe it was, and said, when this is all over, people will say the history of the American Revolution was Franklin with his lightning rod and George Washington with his sword. And basically he meant no one will remember poor John Adams. Now, if the Philadelphia electricians put colonial science on the map, then America's contributions to a pair of astronomical observations made sure that it stayed there. Astronomers knew that in 1761 and again in 1769, the planet Venus could be seen to traverse the face of the sun. This is a rare but recurrent phenomenon and can be used to help determine the absolute size of the universe. Effectively, discrepancies in the observed time of the transit, so as that little black dot, which is Venus, moves across the sun, you measure it, its transit time from different locales, and you can work out what's called the so-called solar parallax, and this allows a relatively accurate determination of the Earth's distance from the sun. For the newly amalgamated American Philosophical Society, the society that Franklin and Bartram had dreamed up in 1743, by this time it actually taken root, had begun to function. And the 1769 transit of Venus on June 6 provided an ideal opportunity to rally around a scientific venture of global importance. Its members were well aware that successful observations and the production of accurate data could secure for the Americans the respect of the skeptical Europeans. Successful efforts by the Philosophical Society, primarily at David Rittenhouse's farm outside Philadelphia, to observe and record the transit helped seal its position as America's premier knowledge association. In fact, American observations eventually proved to be among the most accurate of any taken worldwide. Neville Maskelyne, the King's Astronomer Royal, lauded the Americans, quote, I thank you for the account of the Pennsylvania observations, which seem excellent and complete and do honor to the gentleman who made them. Franklin and his many collaborators ushered in a true knowledge revolution, one that preceded the political rebellion against the British colonial masters, and which upended the established economy of knowledge. Its ideas can later be found in the Declaration of Independence and the other founding documents of the Republic, and in fact, it involved many of the same figures. So I would like to conclude now tonight with a brief reading from the end of the first chapter, which I have called The Age of Franklin. While the useful knowledge societies played no direct role in this revolutionary enterprise, they gave practical expression to the widespread ideas and attitudes that informed first the colonial rebellion and then the creation of a new nation and a new society. One need only glance at the interests, experience, and attitudes among the signatories to the Declaration of Independence and the founding fathers, Franklin, Jefferson, Rush, Adams, Madison, Hamilton, and Charles Carroll among them, to recognize just how deeply such notions went to the heart of the American Revolution. In a letter to Adams in 1816, Jefferson summed up the prevailing sentiments of this revolutionary generation. Quote, "We are destined to be a barrier against returns of ignorance and barbarism. Old Europe will have to lean on our shoulders and hobble along our side under the monkish trammels of priests and kings as she can." With the final political break with Great Britain, America was now free to shake off the inept meddling of priests and kings and to realize the implicit dream of a natural order, that is, one of harmony and reason that had been perverted by an imperfect Europe. Now, of course, the immediate exigencies of nationhood that followed the successful Revolutionary War left the citizens of this new nation facing an uncertain future. Bereft of many of the institutions of old Europe, lacking in capital and manpower, without great libraries or universities, and cut off from traditional markets by lingering British hostility and the threat of naval blockade, the new free and independent states had little recourse but self-reliance and practical study. Franklin's Society for Useful Knowledge and his many imitators, collaborators, and successors among the virtuosi and ingenious men of the former colonies pointed the way to an American future. Thank you.
Jonathan Lyons, the author of The Society for Useful Knowledge, How Benjamin Franklin and Friends Brought the Enlightenment to America. Lyons spoke at Town Hall on June 27th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW FM 94.9, Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Oregon's legislature voted to commission a study of tuition-free college. It's the pay-it-forward idea. It would allow students to attend college for free and then pay for their degree based on their salary after graduation. It's been catching on with lawmakers around the country looking for solutions to high-interest college loans. State Representative Larry Sequist is considering a proposal for next legislative session. We'll talk with him about what it could mean for access to higher education in Washington State tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Today's KUOW Day sponsor is...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.